This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Liam Fox. Coming up, Australia warned to prepare for a range of scenarios following Bougainville's referendum on independence from Papua New Guinea. Tiny Niue looks to become the first Pacific nation to ban electronic cigarettes. And we look at what it's going to take to lift the fortunes of Pacific Islands teams at the Rugby World Cup. First to Kiribati, where word is slowly filtering out that the government has now published online the report into last year's ferry disaster that killed 95 people, the country's worst maritime accident. It's a damning report that finds the MV Busuroi was unseaworthy, overloaded, and should not have been carrying any passengers. It placed a lot of the responsibility for the tragedy on the ferry's master and operator. Despite that, some in Kiribati believe that many people will continue to blame the government. It's been more than a year and a half since the MV Busuroi sank, killing 95 people, the worst maritime accident in Kiribati's history. But former longtime Member of Parliament Patrick Tasiretta says the pain for many people who lost loved ones remains raw.
They're still crying. They put up their lamentations on the songs. And everything. And we still have it in us.
The government has now published online the full report of the Commission of Inquiry that investigated the tragedy. It describes in harrowing detail the last moments of the ferry and most of those on board. Soon after it left the island of Nonos for the 240-kilometre journey to the capital Tarawa, the main structural crossbeam began to fail. 2 hours later, the hulls began to separate and the cabin and wheelhouse collapsed and sank. Passengers and crew scrambled to get into the two inflatable lifeboats, but one was punctured on the wreckage, the floor of the other failed, and people were left hanging onto inflatable tubes. Those that could got into two dinghies. One of the dinghies capsized and sank 3 days later. By the time a New Zealand search and rescue plane spotted the remaining dinghy, 10 days after the ferry left Nonos, there were only 7 survivors. Of the 95 people who perished, 23 of them were children. One was a pregnant mother who died while giving birth. Patrick Tasiretta says many people blame the government.
This government has already dug its pitiless grave. It's gone already. They're dead.
That's despite the report attributing a lot of the blame to the ferry's master. He ignored a notice by a marine surveyor not to carry passengers. He failed to let maritime authorities know he was departing Nonos as required. He refused to turn the catamaran around when its main structural beam cracked loudly just out from Nonos. He switched off the generator that powered the ferry's radio. He failed to issue a distress message when the boat started to break up. During the scramble to get into the lifeboats, the report said he failed to perform his leading role. He was sitting on one of the capsized hulls, dazed, regretful, and sorry. Opposition MP England Utah says it will take a while for the report's findings to filter out into the community, but he believes many people will continue to blame maritime authorities and the government for the loss of so many lives.
Since the Marine Division was not there to sort of monitor the departure of the vessel and even passengers boarding the vessel when it issued that order, the order not to carry passengers. Who else should we blame for that?
The actions and inactions of the ferry's operator and maritime authorities are also mentioned in the report. The ferry had run aground twice before its final voyage, but the commission said the extent of the damage could not be determined. It was also unseaworthy because its radio license had expired, and the communication system was not fully functional. The report said the operator, TOK's holding company, also contributed to the delay in launching the search and rescue operation. It failed to provide authorities with adequate information early on, refused to accept responsibility, provided false and misleading information to the commission, and showed no concern for the safety of passengers and crew. Mr. Utah says now the report is out. The next step is to hold someone legally responsible for the tragedy.
I think the main issue now is that this matter should be referred to a court, I guess, because that's what we've been arguing all along. from our side in the opposition. Somebody has to be held accountable.
Opposition MP England Yuta there. Australia has been warned it must be ready for a range of options after the upcoming vote on possible independence for Bougainville from Papua New Guinea, including a substantial deterioration in the security situation. A new report from the Lowy Institute says there is majority support for independence on the island, which fought a decade-long civil war with PNG in the 1990s. After being delayed several times this year already, the referendum vote is now scheduled to happen late next month. But that won't be the end of it. PNG and the Bougainville governments will have to hold negotiations after the vote, and PNG's parliament has to ratify the outcome. If it doesn't, that's where the report's author, journalist Ben Bohane, says the potential for another regional crisis rises. He spoke with reporter Sue Lannan.
It seems pretty clear that a solid majority are going to vote for independence. We're probably looking at 75-80% plus. And when that happens, that's going to push PNG and Australia into some interesting policy questions. It's been Australian policy for a long time to basically support Papua New Guinea. So it's going to be very difficult for PNG and Australia to ignore what's likely to be an overwhelming vote for independence.
Well, do you think they will accept it?
It's hard to say. The process now, you know, once the referendum happens, is it has to be ratified in the PNG parliament, and then there's a negotiated outcome between the autonomous government, Bougainville, and the PNG government. There are real questions around whether PNG is going to ratify the vote in parliament, whether there will be some sort of negotiated outcome. It has to be said that the new Merapi government in PNG is showing signs that it is going to embrace the peace process and follow it through. They dispersed funds in the first week of government for the referendum. And so they've created a lot more goodwill, I think, in Bougainville than the previous O'Neill government had. Under the O'Neill government, they'd sent very mixed signals, and in fact, there was a perception that they weren't going to ratify the votes.
How will an independent Bougainville survive economically?
Bougainville's sitting on a lot of resources. You obviously have the Panguna mine, which was a major copper and gold mine through the 60s, 70s and 80s. There's no doubt that there's a lot of mineral wealth there. But Bougainville's also rich in terms of agriculture, good volcanic soil. You have major cocoa plantations from before the war, so a lot of chocolate used to be sourced there. And then on top of that, there's the potential for fishing rights. There's been a lot of focus, probably rightly, on the mining powers, and Bougainville has drawn down its mining powers from PNG now. So it's a lot more in control of the resource sector in Bougainville as part of the autonomous government. But there's been very little attention paid to the fishing rights. And I've seen and heard estimates of anything up to 100 million kina, $30-40 million a year just in the fishing rights alone. It's pretty clear that Bougainville has the resources to be a viable economy and independent state if it's managed well.
Will PNG let go of some of those rights, like fishing rights?
That remains to be seen. If they're prepared to give Bougainville independence and ratify the outcome of the referendum, then, you know, we're looking at not just Bougainville as an island, but Buka and the atolls, Nissen, Green. And if you were to take a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone around that, there's a fair bit of ocean there. And so, yes, the potential for substantial fishing resources is part of that mix too.
Is there a risk, though, it will face teething problems like East Timor has with its oil and gas?
Undoubtedly. The first challenge for Bougainville is really building that sense of unity. There's a lot of people who don't even want to talk about mining and some of these other aspects until they've won independence and are in a better position to negotiate and deal with it.
That's reporter Ben Bohane speaking to Sue Lannan. Australian authorities are looking to deport a convicted murderer to Papua New Guinea, but he's also gravely ill, and his doctor, one of Australia's leading surgeons, is warning his patient could starve within a year if he's sent to PNG. Mark Bassa, who's a Papua New Guinea citizen, was put behind bars 14 years ago when he was just 16 years old and his family was living in the Australian regional city of Newcastle. He's now served his time and has been in an immigration detention centre since he was paroled early last year. Since then, he's been fighting a decision by Australia's Immigration Department to not grant him a visa to join the rest of his family who remain here in Australia. An appeals tribunal urged a rethink on the decision to deport him because of his ill health and the threat of possible retribution in PNG. But as Giselle Wakatama reports, his bid for a protection visa has failed.
Mark Basser left PNG in 2004 and has told the ABC that he has limited or no family ties and would risk living in a shanty town if sent back there.
Basically, I'll be just starting off on the streets and with no money or nothing like that.
In June 2018, the Administrative Appeals Tribunal recommended the Department of Home Affairs rethink its decision not to grant Basser a protection visa due to fears he would die prematurely from ill health or be killed if he was sent back. 16 months on and the department's responded and the decision has not gone Basser's way, with the Minister Peter Dutton deciding to reject the visa. Basser had a third of his pancreas removed while he was in jail in 2007, and he's given approval for his surgeon, Professor Jaz Samrat, to speak exclusively to the ABC. Dr. Samra is one of Australia's most experienced pancreatic surgeons. He says Basser needs a medication known as Creon to survive, taking 3 tablets for every main meal and 1 with every snack each day.
Certainly he would get wasted within a year if he wasn't taking appropriate medications.
Professor Samra says that wastage would be similar to an HIV sufferer.
In the long and in the short run, I am concerned that his survival is likely to be shortened.
Mark Basser says deportation without access to his medicine would render him prone to infection at risk of wastage within months.
There's no hope at all of getting anywhere close to the medical treatment and care that I'd need to. Basically, survival, definitely is death sentence.
Professor Samra says his fears are heightened since learning of the latest development in Basser's case.
So even if he eats well, he has a healthy diet, he wouldn't be able to absorb it properly.
Professor Samra is keen to stress his comments are not politically motivated and he's only speaking out due to his fears for his patient.
I'm not politically aligned in any way or form. I'm just commenting on, in this case, purely as a patient-doctor relationship on those bases.
The ABC spoke to pharmacists in Port Moresby who confirmed that the availability of Creon in PNG is limited and the drug is also expensive. They say the drug's classed as a special order and sent on request from Australia. One pharmacist instead recommended probiotics that are off script and available on the shelf at local pharmacies. But Professor Samra says Basser needs a prescribed medication to survive.
His ability to produce enzymes to digest food is impaired, so he needs these tablets for the absorption of also breakdown of nutrients in his bowel so he can absorb them.
The Department of Home Affairs has told the ABC that when making its decision, it took all of the relevant information and circumstances into account, including the impact on the individual and the individual's family and the safety of the Australian community. Basser is prevented from taking his case back to the Appeals Tribunal and says he is instead thinking of a federal court challenge on the grounds that there was jurisdictional error and error in the decision-making process. But the department says Basser fails Australia's character test.
Giselle Wakatama reporting. Niue could be the first country in the Pacific to ban electronic cigarettes, with its acting premier calling vaping a new challenge to the country's tobacco laws. It comes as a backlash against vaping continues to pick up steam. New research has found it may cause deadly lung disease and be more harmful than once thought. But others say vaping is an effective way to stop smoking, and it could be a lifesaver for many across the Pacific, as Priyanka Srinivasan reports.
Electronic cigarettes might be taking their last puff as governments around the world reconsider their stance on the controversial devices.
The government of India today announced a ban on something called vaping.
Federal and state investigators are trying to get to the bottom of a recent outbreak of lung illnesses that could be linked to vaping.
Over 20 countries have now introduced a ban on vaping, with Niue understood to be the first in the Pacific to consider the policy. Acting Premier Billy Tolonghi told a group of medics visiting the island recently that e-cigarettes could be putting young people at risk. And it's a concern shared by Shelley Burrich, the chief executive of Samoa's Cancer Society.
Vaping is starting to become a norm, if I can say that word, amongst youth, particularly in university, secondary school level.
Ms. Burrich says although no stores in Samoa sell e-cigarettes, it's not uncommon to see young people vaping on campus using products bought online or overseas.
It seems to be cool to be seen vaping.
The fear is that e-cigarettes could be much more harmful than first thought. Sold as a healthier alternative to smoking tobacco, battery-powered e-cigarettes heat up a liquid commonly containing nicotine. The vapor that's produced and inhaled has now been linked to at least 19 deaths in the United States, with thousands of others believed to have suffered lung damage from vaping.
Obviously, the concerns, and specifically with the youth, are completely justified because that's not what these products are designed for.
Jonathan Devery is the owner of Alt, a vaping company based in New Zealand. He believes the injuries and deaths seen in the US may be a result of poor regulation of e-cigarettes and the mixture of illegal substances like THC in the liquid. When well regulated, he says e-cigarettes are a healthier alternative to tobacco.
We don't say that vaping is harmless. What we do say is it's a much less harmful alternative than traditional tobacco. We're quite lucky that the New Zealand government understands that, so has been promoting vaping through the Ministry of Health.
Mr. Devery recently visited Samoa to understand better the public health issues linked with smoking. He believes e-cigarettes could actually help make a dent in the country's high smoking rates.
Currently, we are under product development to try and find a lower cost option for the Pacific Islands where the medium income is significantly lower than here in New Zealand. Once we have a product that we can stand behind and looking to work with either governments or distributors to try and educate the people and look to provide them with a, you know, much less harmful and more cost-effective alternative.
But are e-cigarettes really a less harmful alternative to tobacco smoking?
E-cigarettes tend to be marketed as like reduced risk or risk reduction, but in reality, it's more like risk substitution.
Ada Motsiri is the technical officer of non-communicable diseases at the World Health Organization in Fiji.
So there's not usually tobacco in e-liquids, but there are other ingredients that are similar to tobacco products that might include things like nicotine, which is the addictive substance in tobacco, and further to that, some other chemicals which are also toxic.
She's calling for Pacific governments to follow in Niue's footsteps by considering tougher regulations on the industry.
When it comes to e-cigarettes, these are actually becoming more and more ubiquitous in the Pacific Islands, which is quite alarming. Even the smallest Pacific Islands are seeing these products on store shelves.
But Jonathan Devery from the company Alt says this approach is misguided.
If you're going to ban vaping outright, that's going to be very, very difficult to reduce those smoking rates.
Jonathan Devery from the vaping company Alt sending that report from Priyanka Srinivasan. The high rates of young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in Australia's criminal justice system has led to a raft of intervention measures with varying success. But a group of legal and social workers are worried the mainstream children's court process is failing a whole other population, young Maori and Pacific Islanders. And in one outer suburb in Sydney, where many of these young people are growing up, there are mounting calls for a radical new approach. Gavin Coote has the story.
I was on the wrong path when I was in New Zealand, so when I came to Australia, I knew which path I had to take.
Growing up in a rough area of Auckland, Tommy Satyu reluctantly chose to leave it all behind him at the age of 21. But the move to Sydney's southwest fringe brought its own challenges.
When I got here, it was pretty much sink or swim.
Tommy Satyu is like many other Maori and Pacific Islander migrants who've made the Campbelltown area home. More than 30% of the population here was born overseas, with thousands of residents hailing from New Zealand, Samoa and Fiji. Young Australian Fijian Joseph Rutavo caught the attention of social workers as a troubled teen living in nearby Macquarie Fields.
I think the biggest thing is, for me, is that Fijian culture versus Australian culture, completely different.
He's now a leading figure in the local outreach service, Youth Off the Streets, working to keep the next generation behind him out of crime.
They're coming here with their families and they're disadvantaged from the get-go.
The rates in Campbelltown of juvenile offending are some of the highest in Sydney and consistently above the New South Wales average. Graham Blewett recently retired as the magistrate at Campbelltown Children's Court.
One of the biggest problems I found here at Campbelltown were the number of kids who were not going to school. And that, I think, was probably the biggest yawning gap in the entire process in dealing with young people here. They were got no real hope in life.
The MacArthur Legal Centre represents hundreds of children in court each year and works closely with Maori elders and social workers to provide culturally appropriate services. The centre's children's court coordinator, Laura Sutton, believes the justice system is failing to address the reasons young Maoris and other islanders are offending and all too often re-offending.
They are treated like a different category of citizen and they, you know, that does have a huge impact.
The local community wants a specialist court for Maori youth modelled on the Koori Court, which brings Indigenous offenders in front of two elders and a magistrate, who then work out a plan to help get them back on the right track. Youth worker Joseph Rutavo again.
Family and culture is everything, so you can't work with that young person without first meeting mum, dad, auntie, uncle, brother and sister, and then being able to navigate through that ocean to be able to then get to the young person who's sitting there on that boat.
Youth worker, Fiji-Australian Joseph Rutavo, ending Gavin Coote's report. And finally, as the 29 Rugby World Cup enters its business end, rocked by a typhoon and match cancellations, Pacific Island teams have found the going tough in Japan. Fiji, Samoa and Tonga are all but out of the competition with the final round of group games left to be played. So what will it take for their fortunes to change? Kelvin Anthony takes a look.
They're known as the entertainers in world rugby.
Where tonight it's Wales and Fiji's turn to deliver at the Rugby World Cup in Japan. Shapes short side and heads that direction, just pops it one off to the tank to his side.
But Fiji, Samoa and Tonga's ability, flair and potential hasn't been enough for them to progress beyond the pool stages at rugby's most prestigious event. They now need to wait another 4 years for another chance to try reach the knockout stages. It's a scenario that's left thousands of their fans across the Pacific Ocean and beyond disappointed. It's also renewed calls for World Rugby to re-evaluate its commitment to create an equal playing field for island teams. Seremaia Mbai is a former Fiji international and the director of Fiji's Rugby Academy.
Some of the games are very disappointing and some of the games they perform really well, but it's inconsistent of performance.
Mbai was part of the history-making Flying Fijians team that knocked out Wales to qualify for the quarterfinals at the 2007 World Cup. He says it'll take much more effort before Pacific Island teams are performing well consistently.
We've seen and heard a lot of the players have to choose between country and clubs. You know, those are the issues because clubs, they employ them and they manage to secure them financially.
Pacific Island players are spread across a number of competitions globally. The majority of them ply their trade in Europe, playing for top clubs with massive bank accounts in England, France, Scotland and Wales. They're often bound by contracts that stop them from playing for their countries in international test matches. During a World Cup year, Pacific players spend about 2 to 3 months together, compared to the better established unions whose players have more intensive preparation and time together. Former players have been among those to apply pressure on World Rugby to do more to get Pacific Island teams competing regularly with top-tier nations for real change. In September, All Blacks coach Steve Hansen added his voice.
We have these wonderful ideas about growing the game, but we don't have an organisation at the top that wants to be strong enough to say, right, oh, well, this is what we're doing.
Hansen's claims were later refuted by World Rugby, which said they pumped almost $110 million to support Pacific Island and Tier 2 teams in the Americas to prepare for the World Cup. Former Fiji international Seremaia Mbai says World Rugby and unions in Fiji, Tonga and Samoa need to work together before the next World Cup to be hosted by France in 2023.
World Rugby, they provide the platform, but at the same time, they need to look at how they can develop a concept where a Tier 2 nation can compete during the World Cup.
That's former Fiji international Seremaia Mbai ending Kelvin Anthony's report. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Liam Fox. Thanks for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.